This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Don't Tell Me The Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and this week I'm sitting down with arguably the greatest snooker player of all time, the incomparable Ronnie O'Sullivan. Ronnie is the current world number one. That's after a nine-year gap, and he's the oldest man at the top since 1983. The theme of our conversation is moderation and how Ronnie has embraced it to extend his career and improve his health and happiness, and how you can too. Ronnie struggled with drink, food and depression during his career, but has assembled a toolkit and perspective that have helped him thrive. We discuss how Ronnie used running to manage his mood and his weight, how Steve Peters helped him get perspective and find some calm, and how now his focus is on nutrition and using food to fuel his body and mind properly. Ronnie reveals that if he'd had his time again, he might not choose snooker, and how balance in his life and exercising self-care is all important. It really was an absolute pleasure to have Ronnie on. I'm a huge fan of him as a player and person, and he really opens up in this episode. And if you do enjoy the show and could give it 5 stars and a kind review where possible, I'd be really grateful. It helps spread the word too. And please do subscribe on BBC Sounds if you haven't done already. Also, I love to hear from you on social media. I reply to every message and it really is appreciated when you get in touch. I'm at Simon Mundy, M-U-N-D-I-E. Enough admin and housekeeping for now though. Let's get to the man and legend himself. Here is Ronnie O'Sullivan. Ronnie O'Sullivan, thank you for coming on Don't Tell Me The Score. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Now, excuse the flattery.
Okay.
General consensus, the most talented, the most popular player currently on tour now, and in most people's opinion, ever. But for me, the most important thing, or one of the most impressive things about you, is your longevity. Here you are, don't want to say you're getting on a bit, but you know, in a sportsman's terms, you are.
Yeah.
World number one again.
Yeah.
You know, and early on, would you have expected yourself at this age to A, look as well as you do, and B, to be peaking like this?
It depends how far you go back. If you'd have asked me this when I was maybe 19, going through to my 25s, I'd have said definitely no, because I was in a bit of a rough place then. You know, I didn't really, there was no self-care there. There was no professionalism to the level that there is now. So I'd have probably said, you know, I'd have been happy maybe making a final. I'd been over the moon with winning a world title. Possibly getting to number one would have been nice, and just making a nice living out of it and having fun and not, you know, just doing something I kind of enjoy really. But if you would ask me from 25 onwards, obviously I've, you know, rededicated myself and how I approach the game, and from that moment onwards I've kind of looked to be the best I can possibly be, and obviously I've had to seek out advice and help and challenge myself and take myself out of my comfort zone to try and achieve that. So, you know, it's all great saying I've got talent and this and that, but talent only gets you so far, you know?
Yeah, and you talked there about being the best version of yourself, and I think that's such a good way to look at things.
Yeah.
So many people, like, hit, say, 30, in all areas of life, and sort of think, maybe consciously or unconsciously, they're done.
Yeah.
But that striving to always be better, you know, that's a really valuable thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because I think if you just sort of like say, well, this only applies to you being number one or being the best snooker player, the best tennis player, the best golfer, or the best cook in the world, you know, you're kind of like you're probably alienating, you know, getting rid of like 7.8 billion people, because they'll think, well, that's just kind of not achievable. But if you just say to everyone, you know, whatever it is your passion is, whatever your hobby is, would you like to be the best you can be at it? And I think most people would probably say, yeah. Most people, you know, would like to be better at anything that they do, you know, because I think the better you are at something, the more enjoyment you get out of it. And it's not just about doing it. It's about, you know, it becomes a fabric of your life in a way. And it not only, you know, you not only enjoy what you do more, but it asks more questions of yourself. So like me going on trying to be the best I can be, I've had to dig deep within myself and find out really what it is about my character, and have I got the character, have I got the will, have I got determination? Because sometimes I think I'm a weak person, but actually when I look back at it, I think I've done well, you know, to kind of push on.
And you can be the best version of yourself, not just in terms of something you do, but it's also like can be about the way you are and the being side. You know, being not kinder, being a better listener, all these kind of things. We can all improve in every area. And to me, that's like one of the most key things about life. That's kind of one of the points of life, isn't it? Do you go along with that?
Yeah, I still have to work on that, you know, because what happens is when I play snooker, I go into a tunnel vision type of world, and then I kind of, I don't know I'm doing it, but I just block out everything and everyone around me. And the people that care about me, obviously, don't get the best out of me. And they take it for so long. And then eventually they go, well, I'm not putting up with this. And you kind of think, well, what have I done? You know, I'm out there grafting. I'm trying to be the best I can be. I'm pursuing my career. But actually, they're not getting their wants and needs.
So it's broader than snooker, isn't
it? Yeah. So then you have to go, okay, well, I want a balance in life. You know, I don't just want to be snooker. I've realised and winning titles is great, but it's, you know, if that's all that life is, if what my life is built on is around just being success, then at some point that's going to go, and then what am I left with?
Yeah.
You know, and I think human relationships are very important and probably more important than anything you'd ever do, because, you know, we need to interact with people, and the healthier the relationships you have, the better your life will be. So I have to draw in sometimes and kind of go, okay, you know, maybe I'm being a bit selfish and I've been a bit neglected certain things. And then once I start to reapproach that, you know, life gets better again, you know?
Yeah, it's all about balance and moderation, isn't it? You've got to spread out. That tunnel vision can be quite destructive. You see it with people.
Moderation is hard, and I've had people around me that have said, you know what, certain people got you around you are probably the wrong type of people for you. You need people to support you. And I thought, yeah, that's great, and I have got people to support me. But I just don't want that type of person around me. I want people that have got their own life and are independent and they need supporting as well in many ways, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, otherwise you just kind of, you know, a lot of people that support me, they're great relationships, but, you know, it's, and it's great, but I don't know, you need a bit of everything, I think.
And you talk about relationships, and relationship with self is important as well. And in your cookbook, right, which is this, half it's this huge open up of you know, your inner landscape, really. Yeah. And part of self-care, having a relationship with yourself, is accepting yourself warts and all. And you've spoken about publicly about some of the difficulties you've had, some of the addictions you've had.
Yeah.
But actually accepting that as part of yourself, that's being kind to yourself, and that's a relationship with yourself as well.
Yeah. I think obviously, you know, I went through a lot of denial in the early stages that, you know, I didn't think I had an addiction problem, really. I thought, you know, I'd get a month of training and eating well and practicing and all that sort of stuff, and then I'd play a tournament and I'd do really well, and then for the next 2 or 3 months I would binge on food and drink and going out and, you know, going to nightclubs, and it was never me, but that was just my addictive side. You know, I couldn't just have one night out, one meal, and get back to training the next day. I kind of always kept falling off the wagon, and it wasn't until I started looking at addiction. You know, when you look at addiction, it's not just with food. It can be around women, relationships, gambling,
anything,
spending.
Right?
You know, am I working too hard? Am I a work addict? And I'm like, you know, so it kind of like covers so many different areas.
I think it can even cover thinking. I think, you can get addicted to overthinking, can't you?
Absolutely.
Get addicted to anything.
Yeah. I think the Western world has become a world of addiction in many ways. You know, we've forgot what it's like to just sit down as a community and just do things together and help each other, support each other. I think we live in quite a hectic, fast-paced life, and everyone's trying to get on top of each other. Everyone wants to climb that ladder, and they'll do whatever they do. And I probably do it unconsciously. I kind of think, I'm not like that. But actually, when I get in that tunnel vision, I've probably trampled on so many people, not in a horrible way, but just in my pursuit to be the best. Yeah. And you know, you have to make tough decisions, and sometimes you think, you know, when I look back about it, you know, they were ruthless decisions. And I kind of class myself as not being a ruthless person. But because of that pursuit to be the best that I could be, I sometimes, you know, sometimes you have to do it. And then sometimes you think, well, I go to Thailand and it's not like that. They have a different way of success. They kind of, you look at Manny Pacquiao, he'll feed his village. And, you know, for him, it's all about, you know, taking back to the Philippines, making his. And I think that's a much better way to share your success than think, you know, maybe, you know, you got the Manny Pacquiao way and you got the Floyd Mayweather way. Floyd Mayweather go and buy loads of Bugattis and cars and spend it, and it's bling, bling, bling. And a lot of the Western world think, you know, that's what I aspire to be.
Yeah.
I don't. I aspire to be the more the Manny Pacquiao. I think, for me, he has got the balance right. He's doing it for a greater good. He's, you know, he's taking poverty out of his country. He wants to make his country a better place. And for me, that's the side I would much rather, you know, be. And I have to kind of force myself to kind of be more like that, because I'm around a lot of Western. It doesn't kind of always fit in, you know. So
it's definitely,
you have to do it in your own way.
It is the Western way, you know. It's like seeking, proving externally and seeking externally, you know. And you speak about people struggling to sit still, and you've spoken about, you know, finding a difficulty sort of sitting still, like an impulse to sort of keep going. And I think this is quite interesting, because life can sort of challenge you in an interesting way. So you've been given this talent and work ethic at snooker, right? And basically you've been given this gift that forces you to sit down for long periods of time, often watching something happen on the table you don't enjoy. So it's a blessing and a curse, but it's forced you to grow at the same time.
I really, you know, like snooker, you hear certain sports people talk about their sport, and very rarely you hear certain people talk about their sport in the way that I feel about my sport. You know, footballers seem to be having a great time. They might feel a bit of pressure, but they've got their teammates, the rugby players, you know, they've brought up in a team sort of environment. The only sport where I've seen them throw tantrums and say they can't is tennis.
Yeah.
I read articles on some tennis players and they go through similar sort of emotions as snooker players do. And I just think, snooker is a really, really hard sport. And if I had my time over again, I definitely wouldn't choose snooker as a sport to pursue, because a lot of people said over the years, you know, he's up and down, he's unstable. And I'm not, you know, I've just kind of, I always called it snooker depression. You know, I'm one of them people that lived and breathed a sport, loved it, probably had a bit of an unhealthy relationship with it in the beginning when I was growing up. Not because of my own fault, but just how I was pushed a little bit, like Andre Agassi was. You know, playing and competing, enjoying wasn't enough. I had to win. And if I didn't win and if I lost and I didn't show that I was disappointed, then it was something lacking in me as a person. I was never going to make it, because losing never hurt enough. So I kind of like never really matured in the way that maybe a lot of other people matured naturally, organically, in a way. So I think I've had this unhealthy relationship with snooker, and sometimes, like, doing it through other people, you know, like my father going away when he did, you know, I took a lot of that pressure on, because I thought I didn't want him to feel responsible for if my career didn't develop the way he thought it was going to develop and how everybody else thought it was going to develop. So I didn't want him to feel the blame for that. So I took that on for a while. And then sometimes you think, you know, I'm just doing everything for the wrong reasons and trying to please people. And so I've had that sort of unhealthy sort of, you know, if I lose, I've let everyone down. I haven't really let anyone down, but that's how it feels sometimes, you know.
Sure, yeah. You talk about Andre Agassi. I think, again, the parallels of you and him are really clear. You know, he had, again, was written off in like 97, and then suddenly, you know, later on in his career, he reached world number one sort of later on as well. And he loves sharing the lessons he learned, which you do as well. And you've learned lots of lessons along the way, haven't you? You know, you've used lots of different things to help yourself and are now in a place where you want to share those lessons with other people, because you know it can be of benefit to the wider community, which ties back into the sort of Manny Pacquiao view of life.
Yeah, I mean, I love what I guess he's doing. I know with Steffi Graf, they do a lot of good stuff back in, I think they're Las Vegas. They've done some stuff with schools and helping children and all that sort of stuff. And I really do think that he's found true happiness in giving. I think Andre Agassi is one of them people that, you know, is a giver. You know, and I kind of like put myself in that kind of bracket. I find I receive more when I give. I mean, just for example, there's this young Chinese kid who's 22, he's on the snooker tour, he's got amazing talent. I call him the Federer of snooker. I know a lot of people call me the Federer of snooker, but this kid has got more talent than anyone I've ever seen. Yeah, and I just kind of thought, I'm at the end of my kind of playing days, and I just wanted to, if there was a player that I could help, it's him. And I've kind of, his managers always said to me, will you help this one and help that one? I said, yeah, but while I'm playing, it's a bit difficult. But I just thought, now's the time's right. And I've spent maybe 4 or 5 hours with him on the table, and just a few little things I've just showed him, and he's picked it up so quick.
Really?
And I've said to him, look, you've got 2 years to be world champion. He's never won a tournament. He's never been beyond the semi-finals. His aim is to win a tournament next year. If I can spend enough time with him, I'd like to do what Ray Reardon done for me with him. It's sort of like I said, you know, everyone's like, oh, Ronnie's the most talented, this and that. I wasn't a complete player until I spent 2 years with Ray Reardon. And if I wouldn't have spent them 2 years with Ray Reardon, I maybe would have got one or two world titles at best. Might have achieved number one, but not for the amount of time that I did. Certainly wouldn't be playing as well as I was into my senior years, because I've obviously had to reinvent myself. And a lot of that has meant I can't be as attacking or as aggressive as I think I'd like to be. So I've had to learn to, you know, to win games differently. So I see him as like a little, I hate to say the word project, but someone that I can help and hopefully just watch from afar and just see him become, you know, he reminds me of Justin Bieber. I said, I like Justin Bieber. He's a young kid, handsome. I said, you know, I just got this vision that he'll win the world title and China's going to go absolutely bananas and go, what, you know, where has he come from? You know, it can be one of them things that can just happen overnight, you know, like Tiger Woods or John Daly. They come out and people go, where has he been?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but
burst
the golf,
onto the scene.
Yeah, Boris Becker. You go, what was all that about? You know, and I'd love to see this kid do it.
Amazing. I think you don't forget those people that help you early on. And I think if you remember that, you do want to do the same for other people. Yeah. And then it's that kind of pay it forward type thing. And,
exactly,
and again, it ties into what we're talking about in terms of you know, giving and providing. Yeah. Right. So your lessons, let's talk a little bit about them. Okay. First of all, so when you won your first world title, 2001, right?
Yeah.
What were you like? What was your internal landscape like? We know what you were like. Terrible.
Terrible.
So what was it?
The day the tournament started, I was on the phone to the Samaritans, having panic attacks. The week before I went to the World Championships, I was sitting in my garden around the corner with my partner at the time. Couldn't be around people. I was just about, you know, I could be around her, but I just had these panic attacks and I could just, like, be in a room of people. And I thought, and I remember sitting there, was watching the snooker because it had just started, and Darren Morgan was talking about the World Championships, and he went, well, for me, Ronnie O'Sullivan's the favourite to win this. And I'm sitting there watching it, and she went to me, she said, did you hear that? And I went, what? She went, did you hear what he just said there? And I went, yeah. She went, just go and win it. And I was like, and then I get to Sheffield, and I was doing a radio interview with some, I can't remember who it was, and I was trying to hold it together, and I was just saying all the right things, but inside I was like, whoa, this is not easy for me. And I was just spewing out what I thought they wanted to hear. But this interview felt like it had gone on for about 4 hours, and I just thought, oh, you know, and at one point I just cracked. I said, look, I'm really struggling here. I said, I'm having panic attacks.
You said that, didn't
you? Yeah. And I remember the girl and the woman on there was like, oh, we're really sorry. We hope you're all right. We're going to cut the interview short. And, you know, we just hope you're all right. They were really, really worried. And I remember I was in my hotel room in the Hilton in Sheffield, and I just put the phone down and I went, oh. I just laid on the bed and I went, oh, and I just phoned the Samaritans.
Yeah.
I said, look, I am in a bad place. I said, I'm having these panic. And I was 9-10 months clean out of the Priory. I'd had my best snooker season ever. I'd won 6 out of 11 events. You know, if you was to base success on, like, you know, external things, it was the most successful season any snooker player had had, you know, even including Stephen Hendry. And so I was like, this, in my mind, I'm thinking, even winning tournaments ain't solving my problem, you know. It's like, what is it? You know, why am I feeling like this? And I spoke to her. She said, well, like, don't do anything silly. Da, da, da. So I phoned my doctor up. He already knew that I was having these panic attacks, and he said, look, I can put you on this medication. And da, da, da. I went, look, I don't want to go on medication. I go to meetings. I've been to the Priory. I'm aware that I can be addictive. They've told me not to take pills, so I'm not doing it. Anyway, I got to Sheffield, and I was like, I've got to try these pills just to see if they kind of. So he put me on some serotonin sort of pill, and I took it. And within an hour and a half, the anxiety went. I felt a little bit, because I hadn't taken anything like that before.
Within an hour and a half?
Yeah, within an hour and a half, it kind of like the drug had got into me, and it just sort of like, it's like relaxed me, took the anxiety away, and I thought, oh, I can go and have a coffee around the corner now.
So you function.
I can go and have a coffee, sit in a coffee shop, and I likened it a little bit like, you know, when you're on a train in London, there's just people rushing towards you. That's how it felt. I just felt like in a pure state of panic.
Yeah.
took this tablet and everything just slowed down. And I was like, okay, I can actually now order my coffee, sit down. And if someone comes up and goes, hi, Ronnie, can you sign this? I'll be, yeah, no problem. Yeah. If someone come up and asked me my autograph, I'd have been like, I'd just freeze. And I just thought, I can't be like that. I don't want to be like that, you know? And, yeah. And that's why I have these episodes where I just, you know, I just disappear, I run off, you know, and people think I was having a tantrum. It's just that I can't cope sometimes, yeah. You know, it's not that I can't cope with snooker, it's just can't cope with, like, you know, normal life sometimes, yeah. You know?
And people can read those external reactions totally wrong. And you talk about, you know, your experience of anxiety. So many people can resonate with what that feeling is like. And there is a place then, isn't there, for medication for, like, for some people in those positions as a relief.
Yeah, as a short-term relief, I'd always go, look, if it's for a week, 2 weeks, you're out in America, you're on a business trip, you know, you've got to do it, do it. But I would never...
It's not the long-term answer.
No, I definitely wouldn't do it as a long-term answer. And I just think, for me, like I said, you know, I talk about snooker depression. If I didn't play snooker and didn't have to go for it, I would never have to take any medication ever. It's just that I have this unhealthy relationship with snooker, and a lot of my self-worth and value is built around if I do well at snooker, then I'm okay as a person. And but it's not even doing well, because like I said, I won 6 tournaments. That should have been enough, but it was just performance. So I could have won 6 tournaments, but if I was scared about my next performance not being good enough, that's what used to frighten me. I likened it to a little bit like, you know, certain people go on stage and before they go out, they freeze, you know, because it's all about the performance. And that's exactly what it was like with me with snooker. You know, I could do brilliant performances, but it was always about the next one. And am I going to fall apart? Am I just not going to be able to pot a ball? Am I going to embarrass myself out there? Are people going to start laughing at me? They're going to think, you know, he's a fraud. Yeah. And I had all that going on. And if I don't compete and I don't put myself in that situation with snooker, that fear and that anxiety just disappeared. Not overnight. It used to take me about 3 or 4 days before I kind of like would get back to normal. But, you know, I know that by playing, that's what happens to me. And even though I've worked with Steve Peters, it's helped me a lot. I still get moments where I just think, and it's nowhere near as bad as it was, but I still get moments where I just think, oh, you know, I really do doubt myself. And, you know,
it's incredibly common though, isn't it? And you can see why, with that kind of stuff going on, which so many of us have, that why people wouldn't push themselves or put themselves in situations actually though that do force you to grow and perhaps stay in the really safe lane, because you know, okay, you avoid that, the discomfort that you've just spoken about, but that pain can be fuel for growth.
Yeah, I think you just got to manage it. The idea of it is managing it, and I think that's what I've done over the... I've realised that since 2005, that, you know, I just have to see it coming. I kind of like... I always do like... I do a diary so as I can look back on it and go, okay, what did I do here? And, you know, I hit a little drop, you know, a little bad period here, was because of maybe I take too much on. Sometimes I don't spend enough time at home cooking for myself, looking after myself, you know, spending time with my partner, seeing my children. And kind of once I do all them sort of things, it kind of builds up this big shield and you go, okay, I'm ready to now go into that 2-week battle, you know, and go and do some grafts and try and win this tournament and try and compete against the best snooker players in the world. If I try and do 4 or 5 weeks of competing with the best snooker players in the world, going from hotel room to hotel room and country to country, I start to neglect myself and I start to sort of like question, like, what is this all about? You know, this isn't really making me happy. I've won a couple of tournaments, but really I just can't wait to get home. So I kind of recognise what I can and can't do. I'm not one of these snooker players that just will play in any tournament, any venue, and just think, you know, it's a great opportunity. You know, I like myself a bit like a racehorse. If you keep racing him every day, at some point he's going to get sick of racing and he's going to come last. He's either going to win or he's going to come last. I'm not a mid-pack racehorse. I like to win. I like to compete. I'm not driven by winning, but I like to compete. So as a consequence of competing, that means I like to win. But I'm not one of these that if I don't win, I think, oh, you know, sometimes I think if I don't win, it's a bit of a blessing in disguise. I get an extra few days off, more time to prepare for the next one. What will be, you know, the greater good is maybe the next tournament coming up. So I kind of, it's sort of like recognising it sometimes and just, we're all different. I think we're all bespoke. We all have different ways of approaching things. But I certainly know I'm not a mid-pack player, and that's never going to be right for me. You know, I've always got to aim to try and be at the highest level when I'm competing. Otherwise, there's no point, you know?
Yeah. So the first tool you used along the way, or the most common one we've heard about, is your running that you got into.
Yeah.
And it is a really good way of clearing the mind. And, yeah. You know, it's very, very powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I started when I was about 12, about 13. My dad used to always say to me, healthy body, healthy mind. So he'd get me running 2 or 3 miles around a block. So instead of playing 4 hours snooker, I could play 3 hours snooker, but then I had to do like a 45-minute run. So I'd do that, and then I'd go to my tournament the weekend, and I'd feel great, and I'd win it, you know. And I've always had this little bit. I was always a bit chubby on the chubby side, and I remember if I didn't run, by the time like you know a quarterfinal stage come, I'd be in the toilets, and my armpits would be sweating quite a lot, so I'd have to dry it under the dryer. But then if I had been running for a week or 2 weeks, I noticed at the same time at the tournament, I wasn't sweating. Mm. So I kind of realised, you know, even at a young age, that healthy body, healthy mind were related, yeah. You know. And it, like, I'm one of these, I'm an evidence-based person. Yeah. I have to see things working and go, okay, yeah, I can join the dots now.
That's a great sign as well. You
yeah.
know, having to dry your armpits with a hairdryer.
Yeah, I was only 14. You know, and at 14, I was like a bloke. I had hairy arms. I was like shaving nearly. You know, no one would have believed I was 14. I was beating professional snooker players. But my dad instilled in me younger that healthy body, healthy mind, you'll become a better player. So it's, I've always been about, you know, trying to get the two right, you know, the balance.
And you are a quick runner as well. I know what 10, 35 minutes for a 10K?
Yeah, about 34:50. It was my best time for 10K. So I was
That's
really,
rapid.
Yeah, it was fast. I mean, you know, if you
got 41, I was happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 41's decent. You know, it's like just under 7 minute miling, which is I think anything from 7:30 miling downwards is running. Anything above that, you start to go into jogging mode. Yeah. But yeah, I used to train with a local running club in Woodford. You know, we'd turn up there, there'd be 15, 20 people, you know, lapping around the track, you know, doing our times. And then on Saturday, we'd be over the forest doing hill sessions. Sunday, we'd be doing like long 10, 11 mile runs. I'd be racing once every 2 weeks. Even if I was traveling away at tournaments, I'd be in Ireland, Scotland, it didn't matter where I was, I'd find a cross-country race and compete in that. So running became like a big thing for me. It's like a religion for me, you know. And I always had a problem, you know, with my weight as a kid, like I said, you know, like drying my armpits under the hairdryer just to dry them out. You know, I was always on the biggish side. A lot of people look at me and go, biggish, there's nothing of you. Yeah. But I have to work at that, you know. And, you know, I found with running, you know, when I was running 25, 30, 40 miles a week, you know, you could put any amount of food in me. It wasn't even going to, you know, it wasn't going to put an ounce on me because I was burning it off.
Yeah.
But over the last like 4 or 5 years, I've had so many injuries through the running that I'm not able to run how I used to, and it gets a bit frustrating. So then I turn to food and I turn to other stuff and I neglect myself and I put on like about three stone, you know, and although I wasn't fat and overweight, for me, I felt it, you know. When I was at my fittest, a lot of normal people would go, "You don't look well." And I go, "It's because I'm fit." In my mind, I wouldn't sell that to them because they go, "You need a good meal, Daniel." Yeah. And I'm thinking, "Yeah, I'm running well at the moment. I'm really trying to."
So you took that as a like, validation?
Yeah, I'd go, "You know what, mate, can you say that again, please?" Because we'd be down the running club and a lot of people would go, like, we'd all have the same stories. They'd go, "You know, my friend says I don't look well," but, you know, they were race fit.
Yeah.
And to be race fit, you've got to be gaunt. You haven't got to be gaunt, but that's just what happens. You know, when you're fit and you're racing well, I did look kind of ill.
Yeah.
But I felt fantastic, you know. I got out of the station at Holborn and it was like about eight miles to my house. And I looked at it, I thought it was loads of traffic, loads of people. I had a pair of leather boots on with a zip on the back, my jeans and my cardigan. And I was so fit. I run home for 8 miles, never got out of breath and I was flying. And I just remember people looking at me thinking like, you know, but just an 8-10 mile run at 6 minute miling was nothing. It was just like a normal run, you know. And, you know, them moments, them, I'm more proud of them moments than I am of winning the world championships. People go, what's your proudest moment? I go, winning the race in Epping. I won this, you know, it was like a bit of a fun run, but there was a lot of decent runners there. And I come in and I run 5 mile in 27 minutes and people are like, bloody hell, that's a bit of a good time, you know. And and then I won a local race at my other club, Orion, you know, the handicap run. I come 180th in the Southern England cross country, 9 miles over Parliament Hill. Really proud of that. 34 minutes in a race, 10K race in France. So they're all my like proudest achievements because not many people know about that. But that's something that, you know, I had a 10-12 year period where I was just addicted to running, if you like, you know, because it kind of ticked a lot of my other problems. You know, a lot of my other problems I didn't need to worry about. Yeah. If I run, it kept me on the straight and narrow. So that's why I get a little bit scared now, because I can't run, because I think, well, what am I going to do?
It's and like, you need something else, don't you?
I mean, something.
And obviously nutrition is your thing. We're going to get onto that in a sec. Yeah. And the thing about, that struck me about when you talk about the running, with it's really good at burning off anxiety. I think that's the thing. Yeah. But so, tool number two that's well publicised to you is Steve Peters. Steve had been on the pod, amazing man, talks about managing the mind.
Yeah.
So what did you take from your time with Steve and how did you apply it? Because that was, I think everyone saw that was had a noticeable impact on you.
Yeah, I think he just put the brakes on, you know, when I was out there and all these emotions and all, like, you know, like when I walked out against Stephen Hendry halfway through the match, you know, that was felt really real and the right thing to do at the time. But looking back, I would now realise that, you know, that was just, when I feel like that, don't act on it, you know, it's very fickle.
Is it your chimp?
Yeah, in another 10 minutes, and I know this from even before Steve Peters, one shot, one frame, one thing can happen and I can be flying. But I never sort of like, I always used to tell myself, that ain't going to happen today. So I'd think it's a waste of time, give up, don't bother. You know, it's not your week. You're not going to win this tournament playing the way you are.
So negative self-chat.
Yeah, and I'd subconsciously just give up, walk out. The same thing, walking out, giving up, playing the wrong shots, putting a towel over your head, doing all them sort of things. That's like my way of going, I'm out of here, you know.
Checked out.
Walking out was obviously the most...
obvious one.
Yeah, that was the most shocking for most people. Like, she's walked out. Like, that's serious stuff, you know. No one does that. So I kind of learned that, from Steve, that not to do that.
Yeah.
So even if I was feeling really awful out there, I'd go, all right, in the next shot, the next thing, it can all turn around. And it's all like healthier dialogue with yourself sort of thing. So that was something that helped out. Obviously, there's a lot more other stuff in there.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, my ability, my hard work, it's probably, you know, probably only one or two players in the game that would, three or four players that would work as hard as me. I kind of thought, well, okay, I've got that. I've got to have faith in myself. Just don't sabotage.
Yeah.
So whatever happens out there, you might be not playing great. Things aren't really going for you. Just don't sabotage. Just keep giving the best that you can give on any shot, anything, and just see where it takes you. And that's all I've done, really. I've worked really hard on what's important in my life, like my running, you know, my gym, spending time at home, and all them sort of stuff that Steve puts in, you know, your values and what's important to you. But I've done a lot of that in recovery as well. So when I kind of got into rehab, I started to, you know, put myself first a bit, you know, to start taking care of yourself. Mm. So a lot of the values that Steve talks about, and people, it's like, you know, what's important to you, and taking care of myself was important to me. You know, do I eat right? Do I sleep right? You know, am I enjoying? You know, am I keeping myself fit? And, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And am I finding things for the time for the things I enjoy, you know, am I spending enough time with my partner, and you know, all that sort of stuff. And you just kind of go, well, that's really important. Now I can go and play snooker, you know, and if I win, great, and if I don't, it's not the end of the world. There's still life, you know.
So that the self-care has to come first. So Steve essentially, in a nutshell, taught you about the value of your values and learning not to buy into that chimp reactive voice and letting it sort of pass. Okay, and you talked about, let's get on to your nutrition then, because, you know, you say your dad instilled in you from an early age, healthy body, healthy mind.
Yeah.
And you've spoken about, you've had throughout your life an emotional relationship with food that was sort of, and it's hard as well on the road. Goodness, I stayed in a hotel last night to come and interview you.
Yeah.
even the breakfast. I mean, it killed me this morning. It's only one morning, but you know, it's hard, isn't it?
What did you have for breakfast here?
Okay, I had. I had muesli with some yogurt and some berries. Start positive.
That's all right. Quite.
Then I had 2 bacon, 2 egg, hash brown, and a piece of toast. I don't do it often. Like, I normally eat pretty well, but I thought.
Sod it.
Yeah,
that's all right. That's all right. No,
you've got to do that occasionally because that's balance as well.
If you're staying in hotels every week and you were doing that, then it's a danger.
But that's what I mean. It's hard and you spend a lot of time on the road.
Yeah.
You know, and if you've got all this stuff going on, so of course, some days you're going to be restrained.
Yeah.
But anyway, so what has been your emotional relationship with food and how has it developed then?
I was ever since I was younger, I was always. Everyone used to say, oh, he's got puppy fat, you know, he'll grow, it will come off of him. But like the time I got to 18, 19, I'm thinking, this puppy fat ain't coming off me. I'm not a puppy no more. So I started to think, well, you got to actually do something about it. And it wasn't until I got a picture in my phone that someone sent to me, and I was so fat. I mean, I'll show you after. You were going, I'm not sure, you might go, oh, yeah, I remember that. But most people look and go, God, I can't believe you was actually that big.
Yeah.
And, so my relationship with food was not great. And I remember I finished the 1996 World Championships and I'd lost my driving licence. I had no girlfriend. I had no nothing. I was fat. I was overweight. But I got to the semis of the world and I kind of thought, I'm actually like quite looking forward. And I took Hendry to like 17, 13 or something like that. And I felt, well, that ain't bad, you know. I'm not far away now, you know. So I kind of went, all right, I'm going to give next year a really good go. So I got myself fit. I was training 3 times a day. So I'd go for a run in the morning, maybe 5 miles. I'd get a cab to the gym in the afternoon, cab to the gym in the evening. And in between them gym sessions and running, my mum would cook me really nice salads and pastas and good food. And I remember after about 2 months, I just looked in the mirror in my bedroom and I was like, I didn't even recognise it.
Really?
I didn't even recognise myself. I had abs, I was defined. I just couldn't believe it. And that's when I realised that... The relationship between training and food and all that sort of stuff, that's when the penny sort of dropped to me. But I couldn't sustain it because, I don't know, I just kind of got sucked into my snooker again. I neglected myself.
Sure.
I started eating. I didn't, you know, I just thought, I always had this thing, if you're training and you're eating, it doesn't matter what you eat, you know, and I've come to realise that it's not like that, you know, to get healthy and fit. And feel the best you can. They've both got to kind of like really work together, really.
And everyone does fall off the wagon. And you've got to be not too harsh with yourself in those moments. Because when you harsh with yourself, that's when it can snowball.
Yeah.
The shame comes in and da-da-da.
I just think it's like balancing the books out. So like a lot of the time I know what I need to eat during the day. And I kind of portion size my meals and I have my snacks on the go. So if I'm going away somewhere, I go to the nearest Marx's, I get 3 or 4 items that I need that can keep me going for the day. If in between that I get a chance to order a healthy meal, I'll have a healthy meal. I won't touch my snacks. But if not, I know I've always got my backup sort of thing to get me through the day. But I just kind of like... When I was training 3 times a day, I didn't really have enough time to eat big meals because I knew I had a next gym session to come up. So I thought, I don't want to eat too much because I'll... So actually... When the more I trained, the less I kind of felt like I ate in many ways. So when I was, you know, I go through periods sometimes where I'll exercise twice a day. I do a 5-6 mile run in the morning and then I go to the gym in the evening. But in between them sessions, I have to be careful not to eat too much. So I found the more I trained, the less I kind of ate. And I was like, you know, so sometimes you start thinking to yourself, do we actually need this amount of food? I just think sometimes it's just done out of boredom, out of addiction, out of, you know, I think your stomach maybe just swells up more the more you put into it, the more it needs. It's like feeding this sort of thing
and being out of touch with you know, knowing when you're full. I think that's quite coming out of touch with your feelings.
And I just think, you know, like, if you put a massive plate of food in front of me, I could eat it, but there's no need, you know. I could probably get away with eating a quarter of it. But it wasn't until I started working with Rhiannon and she started to say, right, well, measure your food out. And I thought, I can't be one of these people measuring my food out. What am I going to do if I'm in a snooker tournament? I asked the woman if she's got a set of scales so I can weigh my chicken and my potatoes out. She's I think I'm absolutely off my head. But actually, I realised, it dawned on me, I'd done a week of it, and then I went, one morning I went, I don't need to measure my porridge, I don't need to measure. And I was like, okay, I now know what a portion size should be for someone like me.
Yeah.
So now I can go out and I can go, okay, they might bring me up a massive steak or a load of this and a load of that.
And you look at it.
And I just cut it, the size I need, and I take the potatoes that I need, and I take the vegetables, and I create my own little dinner, and I leave that to the side, and I go, well, look, that's if someone else wants it, great. If not, then I pack that up and take it away, and I've got another two meals there.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't buy into this, oh, because it's on my plate, I need to eat it. You know, it's sort of, that's what I used, you know, it's just going along with the flow.
Yeah.
I don't want to go along with the flow. I've been educated. Someone showed me a different way. You know, I need to now use that knowledge that I've got to my advantage, and just kind of like, you know, be the creator of your own destiny, if you like. You know,
Portion controls are absolutely key, isn't it?
Yeah.
And now, so when you got in touch with Rhiannon, was it 2017 roughly?
Yeah,
you spoke about in your book about how you'd gone through this period of like really cutting out carbs, which is really like so many people advocate that at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen it with intermittent fasting on YouTube, which I tried for a while, and there's a real sort of talk around it. And along with that mentality, you were eating pretty healthily, quote unquote, but you were noticing, I know you were smashing the avocados, but you were noticing that actually you were really struggling because you talk about snooker being an endurance sport, but your mind was not keeping up.
Yeah, it was... I think it's about after 2 months of just eating avocados, cutting out the carbs, having a bit of protein. And don't get me wrong, I felt all right on it. I thought I'm cutting out lots of the sugary stuff. It kind of like stopped me from wanting, it kept me fuller, you know, eating avocado and you are full. You know, I was eating two or three a day. That, you know, once I'd ate my avocado, there was no like snacking on chocolate, these crisps, you know, there was no need for it. You know, I didn't crave it sort of thing. So I thought, you know, this is working pretty well. And it wasn't, and I was training, I was doing my 4 mile runs and felt fine, no problem. It wasn't till about 2.5 months into it that obviously the effects started to happen, and I was just having dizzy periods. I couldn't really have a conversation with anyone, and this all happened just after the World Championships. And my girlfriend said to me, she said, you need to go to the doctors, you need to get some tests done, you know, it could be low in this, low in that. Went to the doctors. I went to two or three different doctors because they could find nothing wrong with me. And so I was getting like pretty concerned because I thought, I don't like this, you know, like, I just didn't like the feeling that I had. And it wasn't until I spoke to Rhiannon and told her exactly what I'd done. And she was like, ah, that makes sense. You're not, you know, carbs feed the brain. And I was like, really? I just assumed whatever you put in your body was just food and calories. And it would all kind of at some point just, you'd function okay. Because I wasn't starving myself, I wasn't overeating. And it wasn't until I started following the food plan that she kind of put towards me, then I kind of got myself better. And obviously, since that day, you know, it's been like nearly 18 months now, I can honestly say I've probably felt the best I've ever felt.
Really?
You know, my relationship with food, absolutely. Because I was like an all or nothing. If I was training, I would eat well. If I wasn't training, I'd let myself go and think, well, because I'm not training, at some point I'm going to get fat, because that's what's always happened to me. So I might as well eat what I like. It doesn't matter. And I know a lot of people do that as well, because I train down the gym, and a lot of people let themselves go if they don't train. But I just thought, you know, I've got this book coming out. I want it to be authentic. I want it to be like, try not training. So over a 12-week period, I probably only trained for about 3 weeks, but I kept eating very, very well. I didn't put a pound on.
Really?
Yeah. So I know that over a 12-week period, so that was like about a 3-month period. And I always think it takes 8 weeks for any change to have an impact. So if you start eating well, you won't see it within the first 4, 5, 6 weeks. In 8 weeks' time, you'll go, okay, I see the definition. I see the weight coming off. I've stabilized. The body's caught up. And I think it's the same as if you eat rubbish. You know, you can eat rubbish for the first 4 or 5 weeks. You think, I'm getting away with this. But on the 8th or 9th week, you'll look in the mirror and you'll go, wow, where did that gut come from? So I always think you need to give yourself the 8 to 10 week, 12 week. I went 12 weeks just to be safe. So now that message in my head is, if you don't train, you might as well eat rubbish. That no longer exists. You know, there's still the urge sometimes, you think, I'm not training, I'll snack a little bit more and I'll do, you know, I might have a little bit of a dessert here. But I've managed to really keep it under control. So as I know that now, this book that I've put out, it's more about eating balanced meals and not over putting too much food on your plate. Yeah. And if you do that, you don't have to train. I like to train. I like the feeling of being fit, just because it's a great feeling. Like I said, when I got the train station at Holborn, I thought, well, I ain't getting a train home. I'm running home.
In your boots.
That's an amazing feeling. Yeah. To me, that was like, that was brilliant. You know, I couldn't do it now, but at the time, you know, and I just think, you know, why wouldn't you want to make yourself feel like that if you can. So training is important, but for most people in this country, they don't have time to do it all. So I do believe the food is the most important part now.
And it must be good to know then that now you can let go of the training.
Yeah.
You know, you don't necessarily, of course you want to do that, yeah. and that's the right way to be. Mm. But if you did let go,
yeah.
you know, with the new way you're approaching food, yeah. that's okay. You'll be all right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. And I kind of like, I liken to it a little bit like a boxer. You know, they might finish a fight and they might go, you know what, I'm gonna slack off for 4 or 5 weeks. I ain't got a fight for another 5-6 months. I've trained hard for 3 months. So they kind of go, all right, I'm going to have a fish and chips, I'm going to have this, and they might put on a stone or a stone and a half, but at least they know that, okay, once it's ready to train, I cut my portion sizes down, my nutrition, you know, whatever it is. And it's like you've got two ways of living. You know, you don't have to be strict all the time. Mm. But if someone's got a wedding coming up or they think, you know, 3 months, you know, rather than guessing their way through it, here's a plan. If I follow this to 12 weeks, it's like science. I believe in science. And I think that if you follow this, if I do A, B, C, I'm going to get to D. I don't want to be doing A, B, C and I don't get to D because then I'm going to think, well, what's the point of doing it? You know, I want something that's tried and tested that's going to work. And that's a little bit how I kind of look at it. I give myself a little bit of leeway and I don't beat myself up. But, you know, whereas before I would be, you know, bad would be sort of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 was bad. Now I don't go beyond maybe, you know, 3.
Right.
You know, like, you know, 4, 3, you know what I mean?
And it's the balance thing.
Yeah, balance. And for me, it feels natural now. Yeah, at first, yeah. I was like, you know, how am I going to keep this up? But actually, once you get into it, a rhythm of it, it becomes part of your lifestyle.
So the book's top of your game, right? So what are your, and I've said, it's a fascinating read. It's not just a cookbook, is it? Yeah. It is a mea culpa in many ways and an opening of your heart, your soul. Mm. But what are your, you've talked about the ABCs, what are your food ABCs in a nutshell then? So someone listening, what can they apply simply? You've talked about portion control being one, getting your carbs back in, so I'm guessing that's getting all your food groups. Yeah. In a nutshell, what are the rules that you apply then?
The rules, I would always say I'll have 3 meals a day and 2 snacks a day. Sometimes I can't get 3 meals in a day, so I'll just snack my way through the day, but I'm always snacking on the right type of stuff. Obviously, portion size is very important because, like you say, I can, you know, where I was eating 3 avocados a day, really I should have only had a half. So it's kind of like learning, you know, you need your proteins, you need your carbs, you need your fats, you need your fluids as well. You know, water's a very important thing to do. I used to drink a lot of tea, maybe 10, 15 cups a day. I try and minimise that down there to 2 or 3 if I can. I drink a lot more flavoured teas, licorice teas. And at first you think, I can't drink these teas. But you find a really good one. You go, you know what, I really like that. So the more you embrace the different options, sooner or later you come across a sausage you really love. Sooner or later you come across a vegetable you really love. Sooner or later you come across a new fish that you really love. At first you might go, I can't eat that, I can't eat that. But at some point you go, you know what, I actually really like that. And then, you know, it's like I've had hummus probably every day for the last 18 months. And I like hummus, but I only had it when I went to a Turkish restaurant and they'd bring it to the table. I'm like, oh, I really like this. I didn't realise I could make my own. I didn't realise I could go to Marx's and that would be better than having a Snickers bar. Yeah. I didn't realise sticking a bit of celery into a bit of cottage cheese could be so nice with a few sun-dried tomatoes, a few artichokes and a few slices of turkey. I didn't have to go to the local delicatessens for them to... I could do it all myself, you know. So, you know, I think for the first week or 2 weeks... You know, measuring food is important if you're going to embrace something like this, just to re-educate yourself on what is the right amount, because you'll be surprised that by doing that, after about a month of it, you'll go to a restaurant and they'll serve up a plate of food, or you'll see people and you'll go, I can't believe that that's what I used to eat. So then that message starts to get through to you. And you, so instead of going, oh, this is too big, and you go, I'll have half of it, but I'm going to pack the other half. And I just think also, which is important, how you cook your food. So, you know, I didn't realise how fattening oil was. Oil is a good thing, you know, olive oil, argan oil, coconut oil. But taking in the right amounts is okay. But if you're kind of chips and fish and deep-fried chicken, Kentucky Fried Chicken, it's soaked in oil, you're not only having the chicken, which is enough on its own if it's steamed or grilled, you've then got all that oil. So it's unnecessary calories. So it's learning to cook in different ways. So, you know, making different choices. If you go to a restaurant, you know, steamed, grilled, baked, fantastic. Yeah. You know, portion size, you can't go wrong. And it's just, I just think that if you go along them principles, you know, you're you're going to be fine.
Yeah, so top of your game, great read, also simple, okay? Mm. Now, okay, so we've been talking, Ronnie, about the lessons you've learned, the lessons that other people can learn from you,
yeah.
Moderation, which is like your absolute watchword. So, okay, if sat in front of you now,
yeah.
17, 18-year-old Ronnie yeah. O'Sullivan, right, what would be your message to him? And there, through that, the message to people listening who may be like the young Ronnie O'Sullivan.
Moderation, you've got to be careful because, like, I found the thing with food and I'm like, okay, now if I eat right, I don't have this fear of getting fat again. But as a consequence of that, I've gone, well, I'm not actually going to train as much now. So that moderation is a danger because you can get sometimes I've got a bit lazy and I know how good I feel when I exercise or I train or I do some sort of physical activity. It doesn't have to be, it can be just driving a go-kart. It could be, you know, helping my mum tidy up the house or lifting boxes up or emptying the garage. To me, that's kind of a physical activity. So moderation is good in a way if it's applied without being lazy and trying to find a shortcut. You know, I don't believe in shortcuts. I don't believe there's a quick way to success.
Yeah. You've got to do it all,
yeah.
But without going over or under.
Yeah, yeah. I think you get the best out of yourself. I think you always seek, like if I went to the running club, I had a danger of overrunning, overtraining. I think I have to run hard every day to become better. I got a good coach and he would only let me run hard twice a week. The rest of it had to be steady running. And I started running my best times. So sometimes the moderation is seeking out someone that's been there, done it before, and going, look, you know, you don't have to go hard it every day. You know, two hard sessions a week is enough. So once I started to learn that about running, I started to apply that to my snooker because I thought, I noticed that that's a trait of mine to just overdo it and just think that I need to play hard every day. I need to be putting 5-6 hours in every day. And that wasn't actually the case. So when I started to apply what I'd learned from running to snooker, I started to play 3 or 4 days a week. Some days I play for 4 hours, some days I play for an hour and a half. But I equated the four-hour session as a hard session, the hour and a half as a recovery day. I was still playing. I was still in touch with the game. But it was kind of, it was like a recovery day. So it was in 2 days' time when I had a hard session, I was ready. Mm. You know, I'd been to the gym, I trained, I'd ate well, I hadn't overdone the snooker. Mm. So I was ready to perform to a higher level. And I liken it to the racehorse. You know, you don't race it every day. You hold it back a bit.
Okay, so it is all about moderation. Look, Ronnie O'Sullivan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It really has. Thank you so much for coming on Don't Tell Me The Score.
Lovely. Thank you. Cheers, Simon. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score with the great Ronnie O'Sullivan, talking about the benefits we can all get by embracing moderation in life. If you enjoyed this episode, a kind review and 5 stars would be really gratefully received, and I'd be delighted to hear from you on social media, of course. Tag Ronnie too, obviously. I'm at Simon Mundy, M-U-N-D-I-E. Always delighted to hear from you. Always try and reply. And appreciate you just taking the time to listen. That's it for now. Hope you can tune in again next time. Many thanks and goodbye.
Beyond Today is the daily podcast from Radio 4. It asks one big question about one big story in the news and beyond.
I'm Tina Dehealy.
I'm Matthew Price.
And along with a team of curious producers, we are searching for answers that change the way we see the world.
Subscribe to us on BBC Sounds.
And join in on the hashtag Beyond Today.
I went down, you went up.